You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
City Limits. Brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9am.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment.
To transport and planning and housing issues.
To privatisations and our utility services.
To building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
Ah yes, the excitement mounts and the tune comes on and City Limits balance into air, and it's the third Wednesday of the month. It's our normal housing day, so we're going to be talking, believe it or not, housing. And I'm Kevin Healy, and Timothy's over there pressing buttons this morning. And Timothy, a cup of tea, by the way. I presume you want a cup of tea, do you?
Oh, thank goodness, please.
I introduce you to this new Chinese green tea this morning.
I saw it in the kitchen.
So you'll see what it's really like when it comes out as tea. Now, you've got a choice between a sort of grey and white half thing or a Vietnam Morale from Ministry cup.
I'll just have the biggest, please.
The
biggest.
The biggest, okay. Well, that's the biggest.
The largest.
The bigger.
The volumist.
Wish you'd get your language for your grammar pride. It's bigger. There's only two of them. Bigger, not biggest. Good God, what a grammatical error that was. okay, housing. I'm going to have Shane McGrath, of course, as usual, in the Housing with the Aged Action Group coming in. And he'll talk to us about issues to do with the Housing with the Aged Action Group, believe it or not. And in the second half, last week we had, of course, David Spratt talking to us about 50 years of history here at 3CR and the Zionist lobby trying to close us down. The week before on transport, we had John McPherson giving us an update on 50 years. And today, Kate Shaw, geographer at Melbourne and long-time activist on these sort of issues, is going to give us a rundown of 50 years of housing. So we're looking forward to that. And that's this morning's program. So we're sort of going backwards to maybe go forwards, or who knows, whatever. I'm going to have a sip of tea now. Hang on a tick. There it is, that new tea. You'll be pleased to know, Antimony, I'm sure you will, Farage, anyway.
That's Nigel.
Yeah, Nigel Farage. That's right. Nigel, couldn't think of his name. Isn't that awful? Oh, what an impression he's made. Nigel Farage. Now, this is quite extraordinary. I think we might have mentioned it last week, he's got done for taking donations, millions of dollars and in money and kind, and not declaring them when he should have under the electoral laws. But now he says, well, you know, he's resigned his seat, he's going to rerun for it. And he says, but this is the logical, I think it's interesting to know that the only opposition he looks like getting is a garbage bin, which I think is in itself appropriate in this situation. But also, he says that if the people voting back in, that will prove he didn't do what he did do. That seems to be the logic of it, which is quite extraordinary. He said, quite simply, if I get voted back, but I'm the only one running against a garbage bin, it'll prove that the allegations against me are wrong, that I didn't do what I did, because he did do what he did, but nonetheless, it's going to prove he didn't do it, which I find, logically, he's obviously right on the ball, the old Nige. Can you follow that?
Maybe you can go a bit slower for me.
I think it shows...
If enough people agree with you, then you can get away with anything you want?
That's the Donald Trump philosophy, isn't it?
It seems to be working around for him.
He said he could walk down the street and shoot people, they still vote for him. Not the ones he shot, but the others.
Well, people have been getting shot, and people are still defending him.
Yeah, in fact, it seems to be that, if you've got a car and anywhere near an ICE person in America, I'd drive the other way because...
People have been doing that too, and it hasn't been working very well.
That's true, but apparently everyone drives their car at ICE people and has to get shot. You'd think they'd learn, wouldn't you? But anyway, they keep getting shot. Another one yesterday and a couple more last week, and Oh dear. Just thought I'd mention in passing, because Paul Howes was a great advocate for the working class. He followed Bill Shorten as secretary of the Australian Workers' Union, that great union we all know. He then moved, of course, in fact, during the Qantas dispute, he and the person representing Qantas had a great time because they were partners. She now runs Myers. And he, of course, has moved from one big consulting firm, KPMG, I think he was with, to the one that Luke Sayers had to get out of because of that problem he had at Carlton and with the thing on it's called the Dick thing or something, isn't it called? Anyway, that's it. But you were pleased to know he was photographed with our own Julia Gillard in the Royal Box at Wimbledon last week. So isn't that lovely to know that Paul's still representing the working class in a big time, big, big way.
Oh, honestly, it's like Housewives of Parliament. Just the drummer and the goss.
It is, isn't it? Anyway, he's still out there representing the working class in the Royal Box at Wimbledon. Good old Paul.
Yeah, thanks, Paul.
Yeah, good on you, Paul. But on a more serious note to do with workers, a Chinese woman, a Chinese national, took her own life. And if in this story, Lifeline 131144, I should mention that. But at the Melbourne Detention Centre.
Oh.
But the union says that it's due to the fact that it was taken over by an American contractor called Secure Journeys. And the United Workers Union says that they're way down on staff, and there were not enough staff to monitor her, even though there was mentioning of self-harm. And the workers say the woman was not monitored overnight because of a shortage of staff, and the union said they would not comment on that, but private operator needed to take an action, and workers say the centres are dogged by understaffing, which results in assaults, fires, escapes and widespread use of drugs and et cetera, et cetera. So once again, it's a good classic example of privatising what should be a public function.
It sounds horrible, isn't it?
And this sort of thing happening, yeah, which is pretty dreadful. Another mob who we all love, of course, G8 Education, they were the centre of child abuse claims late last year. Well, now they've discovered also they owe more than $2 million to 1,400 staff members because they just forgot to pay them the right amount. And it's part of that deal where, you know, they used to talk about under work choices where workers and bosses could get together and work on unequal terms. You didn't need unions. They could just work it out themselves, the best result for both, win-win, etc. For individual flexibility arrangements, they're called, and that was the arrangement they had, which has left workers $2 million worse off. So it doesn't always work out for the workers somehow, Antony. Yeah, but I think if there is a win-win, it's certainly a win-win for the bosses. But they're determined to pay them back, and it's just a bit of an oversight, unfortunately. It's always an oversight. They never deliberately underpay workers, by the way. What I find fascinating about that is that if you toss a coin 50 times, or 100 times, say, it's likely to end up roughly 50-50 heads and tails. It might be 48-52 or something, but it's going to come up pretty close to half,
Yeah, there should be a childcare worker out there who's accidentally received $2 million.
Overpaid, that's right. But somehow they never seem to inadvertently overpay people. They only inadvertently underpay, which, you'd think on the law of averages, because they misread the award, you see. They can never quite read the award. Apparently awards are pretty hard to read.
Yeah, they should print it a bit bigger.
Well, that's right. Or make a comic of it or something so they can, they don't have to read anything. Now, last week was our client Climate Day. We talked to David Spratt about, we did end up talking about climate a little bit, but we mostly talked about the attempt by the Zionist lobby to close this station down over 50 years, unsuccessfully, thank goodness. But there are a couple of climate stories probably not good stories, unfortunately. Now, Mark Carney, who, of course, at one stage was the head of the Bank of England as well, and is now in, people who know what a great role he's doing standing up to Trump in as he is currently Prime Minister of Canada. At one stage, though, he was heavily involved for instance, he was the United Nations Special Envoy on Climate Action and Finance. And in 2021, he created the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero. He was a great supporter of doing things about climate change. Now, unfortunately, as Prime Minister, he's just approved a 1,000 kilometre, or it's 998, I think you could say 1,000 kilometre, a pipeline from Alberta, the oil sands in Alberta, to the port near Vancouver. And he says it marks a significant departure for him, et cetera, et cetera. But he said, we can't afford to restrain the growth of an important part of our energy mix, oil and gas, to meet a short-term goal. Now, one assumes the short-term goal is to...
It's a habitable planet for all of us.
Save Mother Earth, I would think. Yeah, that's probably it. But he said... it would have been too expensive for Canadians not to do this, but and this is the beaut bit, I think, he does say that it will be done in the most environmentally sensible way, our conventional oil and gas in the most environmentally sustainable ways, and export them to where they will make the biggest difference. And so apparently you can have an environmentally sustainable way of destroying Mother Earth.
Like the biggest difference in terms of like a 3-degree increase in temperature compared to a 2-degree?
Yeah, all that sort of thing, yeah. So that's pretty awful news. In the same week, Queensland government also decided that it was not going to insist on new AI using renewable energy. It can use fossils if it wants. They're not going to, so it's just going to be use whatever you can, which is mainly up there fossils.
Mm-hmm.
Big week for the environment, because also in the same week, Donald Trump removed the very last vestiges of government assistance to the renewable energy industry. That's really beautiful as well, isn't it?
Also removing protections for endangered species, I saw.
I presume he transferred the subsidies given to renewable energy to the fossils. So he's mates in the fossil industry, one assumes. Yeah.
Think even if we got like 10-year-olds on treadmills at this point, or we like shoveled live puppies into a furnace, I think that would be more ethical at this point than burning fossil fuels.
It certainly would.
But I don't want to give anyone ideas.
No. Hang on to your puppy, though, just in case. Yeah. Just in case. Now, last week, of course, we saw adulation, almost deific adulation of Modi here when he came to Melbourne. And Narendra Modi, I think it's End of Democracy in India Modi, but anyway, he was here, and everyone, like the previous time, Anthony Albanese was telling us what a great man he is. Now, I think most of us know his record, but a bloke from a National Parliamentary Fellow in New Delhi called Cathal Leslie wrote an article in which he said, consider what we are cheering. Modi was Chief Minister of Gujarat during the 2002 riots in which more than 1,000 people were killed. The overwhelming majority of them were Muslim and killed by Hindu mobs. He was accused of complicity in the violence. India's courts ultimately cleared him, but the stain was severe enough that the United States denied him a visa for nearly a decade. His government has since presided over the demolition of mosques, the construction of a temple on the site of one raised by a Hindu mob, and citizenship laws that pointedly excludes Muslims. And he points out that in all the celebrations there were no Muslim people involved, and yet there's 200 million Indians who practice the faith, but they weren't involved in any of these celebrations last week. And it goes on and on, but it's just interesting to have those points pointed out. At the same time, our wonderful bank that used to be our bank, the Commonwealth Bank, Commonwealth now brackets private bank, ex-public
Commonwealth Bank
has been getting rid of workers, and it just turns out, the union points out, that the number of workers they've got rid of in Australia in the last year recently, they're now advertising that same number of jobs in India.
Ah, that's coincidence.
Yes. And the union makes the terrible accusation that maybe it's because the wages over there are much less than they have to pay here.
Can't be.
Oh, goodness me. I mean, what a dreadful accusation to make. Mm. You look shocked, Dimini. I'm not surprised.
It's just my morning face. It's just what I look like before 10 a.m.
Right. Now, also, this is just interesting. We don't know what they said because there's no report. Allen and Company, a big company over there in the US, etc., who have a conference every year, and it's called the Billionaire Summer Camp, been held since 1983, and it attracts a who's who of America's richest, but sometimes the world's richest. And no official guest list or agenda is released, and there is a strict media blackout on the meetings that take place behind closed doors. But it must be a lovely get-together. But there's photos here of people arriving. There's Lachlan Murdoch with his wife, Sarah. There's Sam Altman from OpenAI. There's Ivanka Trump. And Real Genius founder Veronica Grazer, CBS personality Gail King, Big Feet production chief Wendy Murdoch, who's part of that same family, of course. Mike Cannon Brooks, our own Atlassian CEO. Robert Thompson, News Corp CEO, again Murdoch. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos and his wife. Federal Reserve Kevin Warsh in America with Olympic chair, and Apple chief Tim Cook. They're the ones they have in the photos going in. But, excuse me, we don't know what they discussed, but we can only imagine they would have been discussing how to overcome poverty around the world and help the working class, I assume.
Oh, thrilling things. I can only imagine those scintillating discussions.
But it's interesting they all turn up, so they must think it's important.
Oh, very convenient to have them all in the same place.
Yeah, it's sort of their version of that Swiss one or the one they have up in the Alps or wherever. Now, also, we've heard since the budget, big business screaming and yelling about the terrible impact they've had on them and the extra taxes they might have to pay, which is bloody awful. But they've found a way around it by the look of it, because apparently small business in Australia currently owes the tax office $100 billion. $100 billion, of which the experts claim they'll never see about $50 billion of it will never be seen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I suppose if you complain madly about the fact that you've got to pay tax, the simplest way to avoid it is just don't pay them.
To not pay the tax?
Yeah, don't pay them. Don't pay the tax. No screaming and yelling about that, $100 billion owed by small business, but we get here and keep hearing how the fact they've got to pay taxes is going to kill them.
Oh, it's these special interest groups, Kevin. It's these identity politics.
Oh.
That's taking over Australia.
Well, yes, it sounds like it. Anyway, that's just, I thought, worth mentioning that they're, but nonetheless, it won't stop them screaming about having to pay the tax they don't pay.
Yeah, it's these small lobby groups who are always demanding concessions from the government.
Yeah, except that they want government
special treatment.
They want government also to keep out, and that's one of Donald Trump's things, of course. We want small government. We don't want government to be involved. But he's, in fact, told business to lower their costs because prices are soaring in America, and it's affecting his popularity. And
the eggs never went down, did they?
No. So Donald has told people in America big business to cut their prices. He's quite worried about it, and of course, experts, the usual capitalist experts say it's ironic that a president who has been touting free markets is actually taking on the socialist hyper-populist playbook. And it's really alarming, said someone from the University of California. But Donald supporters say, no, 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 there is a narrative about the administration being heavy-handed and violating the free market. But everything is based on a fundamental understanding of Economy 101, that when you increase supply, prices go down. The actual substance beyond the rhetoric is unambiguously free market. There's no gun being held to anyone's head. So apparently Donald ordering them to change their prices is still part of the free market that he so loves. Isn't that wonderful? And on those sort of people getting together, a lovely photo, because there's a story about the fact that the head of Westpac, the new head of Westpac, what's going on? Shane is running late over here. Oh, that's a pity, because he's going to clash with Kate.
Maybe we can have an epic crossover.
Be here 9:35, yeah. Why don't we go to Kate now then and get this thing started? And I'll just mention this last one because it is interesting. I got into it. Westpac, there's a photo at the post-budget lunch a couple of months ago with the new head of Westpac, Anthony Miller, sitting between Anthony Albanese and Jim Chalmers. So he had a pretty key spot at the luncheon, which the bank actually sponsored in the first place. Isn't that really interesting? Well, Shane's running late. We just got a message, and we're here at 9:35. So, we'll go to Kate Shaw right now, and we'll take a break and get her on the line.
Tune in to the Beyond the Bars Prison broadcast during NAIDOC Week 2026. Listen to 3CR each weekday at 11 a.m. from Monday the 6th through to Friday the 10th of July. We'll take you inside six Victorian prisons: Dame Phyllis Frost Centre, Barwon Prison, Fulham Correctional Centre, Loddon Prison, Marganite Correctional Centre and Western Plains Correctional Centre. There'll be stories, songs, opinions and poems from the men and women inside while connecting with culture and community. The shows will be live on 3CR 855 on your AM dial, 3CR Digital, and streaming via our website or the Community Radio Plus app. Head to 3cr.org.au/beyondthebars2026 for more information.
This country's black future is a fire.
Kate Shaw on the line. Kate, of course, geographer at Melbourne University. And Kate, we're getting on a bit earlier because we got a message from Shane McGrath that he's running late, so we might have a history interrupt us here for a little bit. But we'll see how we go. But Kate, I did ask you if you could to give us, because you've been involved, I don't want to give your age away, Kate, but you've been involved for a long time, around issues to do with housing and planning in Melbourne, and just a bit of a potted history of 50 years, seeing it's 50 years of 3CR. Can we see where we go from here?
50 years of planning in Melbourne, planning and housing in Melbourne. Wow. It's funny, I was thinking about 1976 when 3CR started. I was still at school. I'm not as old as you, Kevin.
Thanks, Kate.
Friends of mine were kind of, you know, had share houses in Elwood that they were paying $20 a week for, you know, which is a three-bedroom, run-down, rambling places where they were just sitting around smoking bongs and doing what teenagers did in the 70s. Do they still do that now?
I don't know. Ask Antimony. He's a lot younger than us.
Anyway, maybe I don't think I want to know. Things changed a lot, didn't they? It's that those halcyon days of cheap rents and free education. Well, they came later, of course, in the 80s, but still, the Housing Commission still existed. That was formed in 1938, and it was still building public housing right through the 70s and into the early 80s. Education was free. It was a pretty special and incredibly privileged time. Stations like 3CR were forming. And I think a lot of us at the time felt that this is how it was going to be. You know, we were born into an era in which hardships had been suffered. Our older brothers and sisters of the 60s had fought the fight and won. You know, it seemed. There were progressive innovations happening wherever we looked. Gay and feminist and anti-racist campaigns seemed to be not only having been fought and kind of won, but, you know, we were taking over the world. That's how I saw it, anyway.
Well, back in 68, because I am older than you, but in 68 I thought the revolution was coming next week when things were happening across Europe at the time as well, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was just, but our expectations were so high, is the interesting thing. I guess when you're born into a context and all of this stuff is happening, it's like, yeah, this is it. Anyway, it was not to be. Well, the 80s were interesting. So the Housing Commission, the Victorian Housing Commission, was ended, closed down in 1984. That was under John Kane, the first state Labor government for decades. And he established the Ministry for Housing, and there was a Ministry for Planning as well. They were well-intended moves. You know, I think in the housing context, he was looking for, and his ministers were looking for, more human, kind of community-based, mixed housing alternative to what was, I guess, regarded as the kind of the Soviet architecture of the public housing towers, you know, the Housing Commission towers at the time. And I think they were well-motivated. It was just a kind of a cluster of a whole bunch of other things that happened that turned all of this on its head really quickly. But, of course, in the 80s, Hawke and Keating, again, first Labor government on the federal level for decades, floated the Australian dollar. They deregulated the economy. They removed controls on foreign exchange. They deregulated the banking system. They brought in, they gave licenses to foreign banks and removed interest rate controls, phased out tariffs, privatised the Commonwealth Bank that you were talking about just
and,
a moment
and
ago.
Brought in neoliberal capitalism, of course.
All of which created an environment for the free flow of capital, right? So, I mean, I remember people talking about, capital sloshing around the globe, looking for places to invest. And David Harvey, the great social geographer, talked about, the sectoral switches that capital, that money would go through. So at that time, it was all going into the stock market. It was going into shares. That was the home for this free-flowing capital. And then the global stock market crash in 1987 sent money flying out of shares looking for a new home. So where did it go? It went into real estate. And that was Harvey's second sector. It went from the stock market into the real estate market. And so began, in the late 1980s, the financialisation of housing in Australia. That's when it really started. That was when the whole perspective of housing, real estate, urban development changed from providing places to live and work to developing places to invest and make money.
And I can recall that on estates at that time, there was always a worker on the estate funded by the government, but it was under a Labor government, those workers were taken away as well. So they cut back on stuff at that time in Labor governments.
Yeah, it was curious, wasn't it? I mean... Yeah, I don't know what the motivations for that entirely. I mean, that was not really my scene back then. Well, I was young. I was still at school. And then it was early years of uni. But, I mean, there were regional housing councils and there were tenants' associations on the estates, and they were funded by the Labor government during the 80s. I guess they started getting cut back in the late 80s, when the government started to encounter an economic crisis for a whole bunch of complicated reasons that we don't need to go into here, but most of your listeners will probably be aware that after the stock market crash, there was a kind of a mini global recession, and it was on the strength of that that Kennett, the most neoliberal premier that Australia had ever seen, and in fact the world in some respects. I mean, in some respects he was more neoliberal than Thatcher and Reagan in his privatisation agenda. But he came roaring into power on the back of this recession in the early 90s. And so began the program of neoliberalisation and financialisation and privatisation of everything that moved and didn't move, real estate included. So that was when the serious cutbacks happened. The regional housing councils were cut back. The tenants' associations were completely defunded. Well-motivated councils, like St Kilda Council, which is where I lived at the time, were developing their own kind of local housing associations, community housing associations. And the idea at the time was that they be run by locals for locals. And, you know, there was almost a kind of an anarcho-syndicalist kind of view of it. There was a sort of sense of autonomy, and we'll just work small and develop ways of living in ways that suit us and our neighbours and friends, and it was about forming ways that we wanted to live, I suppose. And the St Kilda Housing Association actually was the first community housing association that was funded by the local council in Australia. And particularly in the light of the sort of the vicious Kennett cutbacks, this seemed like a reasonable alternative. Now, even then, it's fascinating to look back, isn't it? Even then, there were people who were strong public advocates who were saying, community housing is not the way to go. And we argued about it. There were big disputes in the 90s, and they carried on into the early 2000s about public or community housing. Back then, I didn't see that community housing was a bad idea. I didn't see them as being in contest with each other, and I thought, let a thousand flowers bloom. Let community housing form. Let co-ops and community land trusts let's have as many different forms of non-market housing as we can. But I think the people who were, I don't know if they were dead opposed to it or whether they were anxious about it, but hell, they were right. They were far-sighted. What they saw was the rampant fashion of the market for financialising everything, but especially housing and real estate. And it was only a matter of time in the sort of 2000s when the community housing associations that by then had proliferated. There was a lot of local councils. There was Yarra Community Housing. A lot of local councils had their own community housing organisations, and they were small, independent, sort of charity-based ones, and they all seemed to be perfectly innocuous, but they started to amalgamate. And they started to build their little empires, and they started to actually behave not much differently from the heavily criticised housing commission in terms of being remote from tenants and slow to respond and uncaring in tenancy management questions. And then, of course, in order for these community housing associations to get stronger and able to invest more and buy more properties, they started seeking private investment. And so they were looking at super funds, they started looking at managed investment schemes, they started looking for private investors wherever they could get them. And, of course, those investors all wanted a return. and all of those people that were worrying about it, decades prior were proved right. And I had to change my mind. In the last 10 years, I've been pretty horrified at the behaviour of the community housing organisations, associations, the registered housing providers that are behaving worse than the Housing Commission ever did. We've talked about this before, Kevin, that, they do things like bundling services, utility provision together so that not only do their tenants not have a choice of utility provider, but they have to buy it from the housing association, in effect, which takes a cut. Rents go up in a way that public housing never did. I mean, at least that was a fixed, 25% of your income, that's that. That's gone out the window now for a lot of housing, our community housing providers. So, we've seen a remarkable turnaround and a vicious fight back from the holders of power since the 60s, and I think now the capitalists and owners of power are stronger and more fierce in defending their turf than they have ever been.
Right. Look, we'll take a quick break here. Just stay on the line, Kate, because
we'll have a little cry.
Yeah, Shane McGrath's here. We'll have to have a briefing with him today, but I'm sure he's got things to tell us.
Do you care about older people's housing? Are you keen to talk to politicians and your community about why housing for older people is important?
Then become a housing champion with Housing for the Age Action Group. The Housing Champions program will train older people to talk about housing leading up to the Victorian election in November this year. For more information and to register your interest, go to Housing for the Age Action Group's website, oldertenants.org.au, or call us on 03 9654 7389.
A 3CR supporter.
Shane, I'm sure you've got some really important things to tell us, and you can also comment on what Kate's been talking about.
Well, my main comment on what Kate's been talking about is I don't normally get to hear the other guests on this show, and it made me feel that my content is quite boring. We're talking about David Harvey and anarcho-syndicalism, and I just come in to talk to you about, the government's thinking about doing this, or here's what the Residential Tenancy Act says about that. Sorry I was late this morning.
Yeah.
How you doing?
Okay, good. But what did you have anything special to talk about?
Well, the main thing that I wanted to talk about is that HAG has a film screening coming up on the 7th of August that is free, but people need to RSVP if they're interested, either through our website or on the phone. I'll give out the phone number a minute if you want to get your pen and paper ready.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a couple of short documentaries. So one is called Bayviews for All, which is about the sort of struggle around the Barrack Beacon housing estate, which people probably know being redeveloped or has been redeveloped. And the other is called The Ranch, which puts the focus on the hidden homelessness crisis on the Mornington Peninsula, a picturesque region with only one crisis accommodation centre, which was threatened with imminent closure. So we're co-presenting the screenings with the Mornington Community Support Centre, and that is at 3 p.m. on Friday the 7th of August at the State Library in the city. And RSVP through our website, which is oldertenants.org.au, or you can give us a call on 9654 7389.
Righty, and on that last point, there's a book just been written. I heard an interview with the author yesterday in which she says that she checked with caravan park people, and one place had said they were getting 300 applications a week for people looking for permanent accommodation. And they've had reached the stage that they've actually closed. They say no waiting list anymore because it gives people hope when there's no hope. So it's pretty serious.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to read the book or find out more about it. But, I mean, that's consistent with what you hear from a lot of homelessness services, that they're not able, lots of retirement housing providers, all kinds of housing providers, I guess, are dealing with that situation of not being able to maintain waiting lists because of the demand.
Yeah, it's damn serious, that's for sure. There's also, in fact, there's an interesting, there's a number of people that... a place called, says he, looking for his glasses, and he got them on his head. That's what they are. Well, they? Right. I don't know where they are. Yeah. Anyway, there's a... Oh, thanks, Shane, just found them under all this paper. right. Well, I organised here this morning. The Layfield Court residents in Albert Park have put a sign up saying, "Declaration of Non-Participation. I declare that I will not meet with Homes Victoria personnel or other contracted parties to discuss my displacement." And they talk about the fact that they're being threatened with, these are older people too, being threatened with, sent out to absolutely inadequate accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
And they just put up a sign and saying, "Get stuffed," effectively, which is pretty good, I think, in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, the organisation by public tenants faced with relocation has been really impressive across all the sites, I think, and that's a great example.
Yeah, look, we'll get back to Kate. You got anything else? I'll go, perhaps some more detail on those films and just what people need to do to contact.
You can check out the information on our website, which is oldertenants.org.au. It's at 3 o'clock in the afternoon at the State Library in the city on the 7th of August.
All right, and we'll get back to Kate, and you're welcome to stick around and join in the conversation if you want.
Sure.
A bit of anarcho-anarchism here or something. Okay, back to Kate Shaw. Kate, thanks for hanging on.
Look, I'm not sure if we do have Kate. Let me double check.
No, we'll have to get her back on the line. Okay,
hang on.
All right, well, let me tell you a little more about the work that we've been doing.
Yep.
One of the things that we have been working on is that the government's currently consulting on a code of practice for retirement village operators. So that's something that our members have been really interested in for a while. We see quite a lot of interpersonal, like everyday sort of bread and butter level misconduct by retirement village operators, or lack of respect for their residents and things like that, and our members are keen for a code of practice that would regulate that in some ways. We don't necessarily think that the approach the government's taken is the best one, which is that the code of practice can inform VCAT decisions if you take things to the tribunal, but isn't necessarily enforceable in its own right. So The draft code of practice says that the operator can't harass a resident. Obviously, that's good. But if you feel that they're breaching that and that they are harassing you, you're not necessarily in a position to take any action based on the breach. There are some provisions in the draft code of practice that would be infringible offences, where there could be, a fine issued for a village failing to comply with the code. But overall, it doesn't have that sort of enforceability that a lot of our members would have preferred. Some of the provisions are really important. There's going to be, in the draft code, there's a requirement that villages have and train their staff in an elder abuse prevention strategy, which I think is a really important protection for residents. So yeah, the submissions on that are open, or the document and the survey are open for comment until the 24th of July. If you're interested, you can check it out on the Engage Victoria website.
Pretty important. I'll talk about it more next month actually as well. Yeah, okay, thanks for that. Kate Shaw on the line. Kate, we'll pick up history again. History interrupt us, but we'll take it up where you left off.
I think I've sort of brought it up to that, really. Just, sorry to bring you all down.
Yeah. There's also, though, the, governments have just backed off completely in the last, 10 or 15 years from public housing altogether. That's pretty important. Hello? Hello?
Well, looks like we might have lost her again, although it sounds like she might be on the line but just not be able to talk to us.
Kate?
Hi, sorry, I am here, yeah. My earbuds just died.
Oh, right.
Yes.
I was just saying that the governments have backed off completely in the last 10 or so years, 15 years maybe, from public housing altogether, and that's an important part of the equation, unfortunately.
Yes. Yes, indeed, it is. With the rise of the financialised community housing sector, which is being treated not as in tandem with public housing, but as a replacement for, public housing is being not just steadily defunded over decades, but now actively demolished. It's kind of, it's worse in full circle, isn't it? The housing situation has now come back to far worse than it was 50 years ago, when the 3CR started and there was a healthy stock of public housing that was around 5%, or actually a bit higher, about close to 7% in Victoria. 50 years ago. So, I don't know. I can't say anything to make anybody more happy, really.
No, Sydney Limits always cheers people up no end. But of course, rents keep going up. The Four Corners the other night also, fingered affordable housing pretty strongly. So-called affordable housing, and get exposed the whole thing, didn't it, pretty much?
Yeah, that was a great show, wasn't it? I didn't know what to expect, actually, because a lot of it was focused on Sydney, so I don't know who they were talking to in Melbourne, but... Yeah, he asked the right questions, and I thought that the federal government's defence of the HAFE program, which is the Housing Affordability Future Fund program, which is dipping money into community housing associations, I thought that the defence of HAFE and of government policy was incredibly weak. I don't think I've ever seen the relevant ministers look so uncomfortable and so ineffectual, really. But does that change their policy?
And, of course, it's all about government money going into the private sector. That was, the key to it. So, therefore, affordability in the private sector is not affordability in terms of people's real incomes.
No, it's not affordable. Even the private sector doesn't acknowledge it as affordable. In fact, there was that interesting woman who had been with the UDIA, the Urban Development, Urban Development Institute of Australia. Was turning around and saying right at the end, I don't know what her name was, I didn't actually catch what she's doing now, but she was turning around and saying we need more direct government investment in housing. I mean, she was a developer saying we need more public housing.
Yeah, she'd worked for Mirvac at some stage, I think.
That's right. Yeah. She'd worked for Mirvac, she'd worked for UDAA, and now she's, I don't know what she's doing, but maybe she's with Mirvac now. Did you see it, Shane?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, no, she's...
I recommend it to everybody. It's on iView. Really, actually worth just... You still there?
Yeah.
Good.
We're still there, and you're still there, and we're all still here.
Yeah, good. I just heard a bit. Worth watching. The right questions were being asked, which is always gratifying, you know, on mainstream TV, actually.
Yeah,
but people having a thought about it.
True, but also there's stories that are in that, but also separately, you know, that rents are just keep going up all the time at the moment, to the point where people get into a place they can afford it, but then suddenly the rent goes up and they can't, and so, you know, it's causing all sorts of problems. I'm sure this caused problems for you, Shane, as well. I mean, in terms of people being forced to, you know, can no longer afford the place they're in.
Yeah, I mean, for a lot of our clients, the rent has been incredibly unaffordable for a long time now. But, you know, our clients are largely on pensions or other sorts of government benefits, and there's just no affordable housing for people in those categories in Melbourne at the moment or in Victoria. So people are often forced to make really difficult decisions about their expenses, you know, cutting down on meals, medication, all the other, you know, things that you know, I mean, I don't want to say that you can be more flexible about, but, you know, if you want to keep a roof over your head, you have to make those really hard calls.
Yeah, there was a woman who was very powerfully interviewed on the Four Corners episode, who's gone into affordable housing, but it was pitched at, it was a percentage of market, but it was also, I think, at 30% of her income, the rent. And then after she'd been there for a year, they increased the rent on the basis that it was in line with market rentals. So it was no longer affected by her income and percent. It was no longer determined by percentage of income at all. It was just determined by percentage of market rent. And the market rents went up, and so her rent went up by, I think it was $100 a week, which meant that she was choosing between... medications precisely and rent.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other big problems that we see with the sort of rampaging rents is that some of the government programs that are designed to assist people to survive these unaffordable rents just haven't kept pace with the market. So, for example, the private rental assistance program, which largely assists people if they've fallen into rent arrears to be able to cover the arrears, you know, sustain their housing. You're only eligible for that if the rent is 50% or less of your income. And essentially, if you're on JobSeeker, you'll never find a rental in Victoria, or you're very unlikely to find a rental in Victoria where you could ever be eligible for the private rental assistance program. So they're turning away the neediest people.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? I mean, even the determinant of government-provided affordable housing in Victoria... is that it be set at 90% of market rent, and a household can't be able to pay more than 30% mm-hmm. of its income, its total income in rent. So it's those two factors, which means that the only sector of the only income segment that is going to qualify. Between 100,000 and 120,000 a year. It can't go below 100,000 because otherwise they're going to be paying more than 30% of their income in rent. They can't go above that. It's just like it's nuts. I mean, and that window is just narrowing and narrowing, which is, I'm sure, why the mob that were providing the affordable housing to this poor woman had to abandon the income percentage because the two and the percentage of market rent just create this vice grip that basically nobody can qualify for.
Yeah, that woman, it went from 30% to 40% of her income when they increased it. But then she said she also has had massive medical problems, and she's really had to make a choice between the medicine she needs and paying the rent. I mean, that's an awful choice.
Yeah. And if you're made homeless, what happens to your medical conditions anyway? You know, I mean, it's just... I mean, look, Kevin, how long have you been doing this show?
Oh, long time, over 30 of those 50 years, but it's time's up, unfortunately, now.
Not the entire 50 years, but let me just say this, that in that time, how much evidence has been provided for all of the other social, health, educational, psychic effects of not having a secure home?
Yeah.
I mean, surely that fundament has been incorporated into the collective psyche by now.
You'd think so, but Kate, but we're here, we'll keep doing it for another X number of years, I hope. Look, time is up, we've got to go. Joe next door is in the studio. But thanks for your time, Kate, and thanks for doing that work for us.
Pleasure.
Okay, and thanks to Shane for coming in. We had to rush him a bit today, but
that's all right. Thanks, Don.
Okay, next week we're talking to about water, and the week after we're going to be talking about uranium with Dave Sweeney. So there you are. Okay, thanks. Here's move on. And Timothy, thanks for keeping us on air.
My pleasure. I'll see you in 2 weeks.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.